This is Dyslexic Design Thinking. For the past 25 years, Gil Gershoni has been the head of his own branding agency, Gershoni Creative. And one of the things he's passionate about rebranding is his dyslexia. In this series, Gil sits down with members of the dyslexic community for eye-opening conversations about the intersection of dyslexia and creativity, and what dyslexia can teach us about ourselves and the world around us. Today, Gil talks to Sally Gardner, an award-winning novelist whose works have been translated into more than 20 languages. Sally has published dozens of books for children and young adults, including I, Coriander, Maggot Moon, and the six-volume series The Tyndems of Rubbish Island. She is also the recipient of the Nestle Children's Book Prize, the Costa Children's Book Prize, and the Carnegie Medal. Enjoy!
Welcome, Sally.
Hello.
It's so great to have you here today with us. You know, I wanted to start by talking about dyslexia and reading. You know, they don't really go hand in hand. What was your relationship with books when you were growing up?
My father had a collection of Dickens that his father had collected from a subscription. You know, you got them in subscription. And Dickens had lived or had worked in the building I grew up in, Gray's Inn in London. And he hated this place. It was Four Raymond Buildings, just about as much as I did. And I used to love thinking of him going up the stairs. There were sandstone stairs. And I was so obsessed with Dickens. My whole family were fairly obsessed with him. And I thought he belonged to our family. And I remember going to school and people saying, how do you know? And I said, oh, it's Dickens. We're related to Dickens, because everything was about Dickens. My father used to quote Dickens. I thought, well, he must be an uncle. I got myself into a lot of trouble, really. I basically got things round the wrong way in my brain. Mm-hmm. And I sort of made stories on top of them. And things got more and more knotted and twisted in my little childhood.
What was the first book you read that really captivated you?
Wuthering Heights. Mm. I didn't read till I was 14. So I got not diagnosed, because in those days there was only the word blind. Mm. I went and saw this terrifying woman called Maisie Holt. And she was in Sloane Square. She had about 100 clocks. And the best part of being with her was when the hour struck, because you at least got 10 minutes of respite. The rest of the time she would shout, boat, moat, coat. And then when the phone rang, she would say, I've got a patient. And I was utterly terrified of her. And then she announced to my parents that I was cured. And I went to a very nice school for supposedly nice girls in London. And I lasted there 6 weeks before I was asked to leave for beating up a girl in a playground. But when I was at the school for very nice girls, we had done a book called Wuthering Heights, which I thought was about a toy box, a little girl with a toy box. And that was one of the reasons they thought I wasn't all there in my head, because it was so off kilter how I'd come up with this story. And then we had a missen hut, which is a horrible little hut with corrugated iron, and it was raining and there were children screaming and the noise was just terrible. And I always told myself story. The way I escaped my childhood was through telling myself story. Mm. You'd only got to give me a little bit of a story and I could spin it happily wherever. But that day I couldn't do anything because of the noise. And I remember picking up this book and starting to read. And suddenly the room disappeared. It was snowing. I was lost on a moor. There was a really scary house. And I had finally got into a book. Mm. And after that, you couldn't get me out of a book, really.
Wow. Amazing. When is the first, as you can spin story, and do you remember the first time you decided to put pen to paper?
Well, I never did. You see, that's the thing about my storytelling. I couldn't read or write. Sally Gardner wasn't bright. And that was the cry. Silly Sally was always followed me wherever I went. But I know when I first told story, I told it to my brother. He was a very, very hyper child. And I told him a story about a monkey called Tiddlywinks. And he loved it. And it would be, you know, he'd jump out of his cot, leap on top of me and say, tell me that story again. And then as I began I could live in my head. I could make things so real in my head. Mm. And then what I used to love doing with a story is to find that place where you can make yourself laugh and find it very, very funny. Or you can make yourself cry. And I loved finding those bits, those moments where you just felt your heart going boom, 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 boom. And really that, I mean, I lived in my head far too much. To be really honest with you, it was not necessarily always the best place to be. But for me, growing up, and for a long time, it was the only place that I could feel safe.
I can relate to that. I think that it's something that a lot of dyslexic have, is that we can see things so clearly in our mind's eye. We're able to imagine and visualize, that sometimes it's a beautiful world to sit in, but can be very introverted and quite in your own reality. I know that I definitely play with that in my childhood. Would you say that your brother is the one that kind of got you into writing? Was that the first relationship that your stories kind of stood out to you, and your inner world was something that you shared?
Well, as I have to be honest, I never wrote them down. My stories, I never wrote. I had them in my head. I only began to write when I went into theater. That's what mm-hmm. I did. I wanted to be a fine artist, but I decided I there wasn't enough story. And people were all into abstract in the time I wanted to do it. And I didn't want abstract. Mm-hmm. So for me, theater was a really brilliant way of doing it. And I think the first time I became conscious about being able to write, or being, maybe this was something I was good at, we were doing a play called The Good Woman of Setzwan by Bertolt Brecht. Mm-hmm. And we were having trouble with a line. And the director said, "Well, Sal, what would you do with it?" And I went, "I'd do da 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 da." And he went, "Wow. That's pretty good. You know, you could be a writer." And it was the first time anyone had ever sort of mentioned that to me as a possibility. And then when I left theater, I was an illustrator, and I came up then with an idea for a little book. And that was the first time I saw author on a contract.
Amazing that you had such a relationship with language and with storytelling, but also not at all, like reading and writing wasn't a thing, but that's where you ended up.
But that doesn't mean one doesn't love language. I mean, yes. I think that it's a real misnomer, this. I get asked a lot, because people go, "Well, you can't be dyslexic, you're a writer." And no. It's the beat of the language I like. Shakespeare mm-hmm. never spelt his name once the right way, ever, mm-hmm. ever once. His language is totally inventive. It's totally magical. He mm-hmm. added more words to the English language. Now we have this stereotype about spelling. It's so rigid that there isn't the play. And the only, why do kids love hip hop? Why do they love all the beat poetry? Because there's play again. And in a way, I loved language. I remember my father was a high Anglican, and we used to go to the King James Bible. I loved that book. Oh my word. That language was just like, give it to me every Sunday. Fine. I'm a loving it. And I remember I loved Shakespeare. I loved Chaucer. I loved the play of words. I loved listening to language. I always had a fantasy about having an actor in a cupboard, and he could come out and read to me, because I just couldn't get enough of books. Mm.
I can imagine that navigating the publishing world in the beginning was probably quite challenging. Where did encouragement come during those times for you?
Well, this is a really strange thing, because in theater, you would think my dyslexia might not be a problem. Mm. Wrong. I couldn't do ground plans. I got the 16 muddled up with a 61. My maths was crap. I couldn't do the ground plans, but my ideas were fucking brilliant. Mm. And no one told me. No one said, "Look, Sal, not everyone has your ideas, but everyone knows what 61 is. Don't worry about it." And it defeated me. And I remember doing a show, again, going back to The Good Woman of Setzwan. It had a starry cast, and I did it with 1,500 car tires. Nobody in England had used car tires. I built the whole city of Setzwan out of these car tires. We had the gods sort of walking. It was magical. And the director said, "I want a curtain. I want you to write Good Woman of Setzwan." Well, I said, "Look, I can, but you've got to give me the book, because I don't know how to spell it." He said, "Well, I'm not giving you the book. You just do it." So I thought I'd done quite well. I sort of thought I'd got it. And as the, you know, audience all clapped, the curtain went up and it said, "The Good Woman of Setchuna." And it got a standing ovation. It got a standing ovation. And my head of design was so furious that I'd let the side down by spelling what he, you know, spelling it wrong, that he made me write it out right. And the director said, "If you ever put the right one up again, I'll fire you. You know, we want the laughter. We want the laugh."
I love the idea that, and I know you and I've talked a lot about it, is not how you spell it, is what do you actually have to say?
Exactly.
You know, and so powerful because it moves from what we look as, we negotiate letters. Therefore, it's very difficult for us to read because it's a whole world of possibilities. I know you published in 2012, I believe it was, you published the book Maggot Moon. Mm. And in the book, the main character is dyslexic. Tell me a little bit about the book and how you came up with that idea.
Well, I got really fed up with people telling me they'd written stories for dyslexic children, and this was a dyslexic character. So what is this dyslexic character, I would ask? He can't spell. Like, really? And that is it? That is just it? He can't spell? And they'd go, "Yeah, well, that's dyslexia." I'd go, No, it isn't. I know quite a few very good dyslexic people who can spell pretty well, but no, that isn't it. So I thought I wanted to try and write about what it was to be dyslexic from the inside. And Standish Treadwell is a boy who sees the world in a very different way. He sees it in images. He sees the blackboard as a load of horses going up and down. The words don't stay still long enough to make sense of. And he's living in a very, very frightening world. And he has one friend called Hector Lush, who's a linear thinker, who's really, really smart. But he is, in a funny way, not as smart as Standish. Because Standish has imagination and Standish has belief. And Hector doesn't. And it is a story of a love affair between these two boys. And it's set in England, as if we didn't win the war, in the motherland. And it is about the time where they're supposedly launching a rocket to the moon. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted just to talk about what it was like to think and be a visual seer, to see the world visually. And that is something that not many people do when they talk about dyslexia. They always go on and on and on about spelling. And there's no magic to that. There's no magic in that word when they use it with us.
How did your book was received by other dyslexics?
That's a very good question. It's very interesting because when I wrote that book, I sent it to my editor. I mean, this is not, you know, this is a bit of a sad story for them, really, because they then said to me, "Hide it. Don't show it to anyone. You can't do that. You can't write that book. You've got a kid being killed in a playground. You can't do that. Put it away. It will ruin your career." And I was very lucky. I met this amazing lady called Sarah Ondedna, and she was starting a Hotkey, a new publishing house. And she said, "Have you got a book for us? You know, I'd like a book live for children about 8. I said, "Well, I haven't really. I've got this book called Maggot Moon." And she said, "Well, look, why don't you just send it to me? And I'm going on holiday, but I most probably won't get back to you for about 3 weeks. But if that," I said, "Fine." So my agent sent it to her. She was on the way to the airport. I just got a bus home. The phone rang. My agent, they want it. She read it and she's absolutely wild. She's got to have it. And I did this thing I've never done before. And I went, "No, I'm going to finish it," because I hadn't finished it. And I knew what I wanted to do with Standish and Hector. And I knew how it was going to end. And I knew also that if I showed it, everyone would go, no. "We can have a sequel. I mean, think what we could do." No. And I really didn't want that. Mm. I knew it was going to be a tight punch. And that's what I wanted to give. And when I did it, I sold it for twice as much.
Wow.
Yeah. And the thing was, they published it beautifully. Hotkey published it absolutely beautifully. It was quite interesting because it's the first time, I think, for a lot of dyslexic students where I've used this book, where they go, wow, this is me. This is me. Mm-hmm. And you know me. I go, yeah, because that was me. And mm-hmm. so I think for dyslexic people, it's a slight relief, really, to have someone who does actually know what it is about. They're not mm-hmm. talking about spelling, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's beautiful when we can put words to others' experiences and it's like, oh, so that's what it's called. Oh, so that's yeah. what's going on. So that's what I'm going through. And often, you know, as you, I'm talking to dyslexics of all ages, and dyslexic maybe that's more in the height of the career, a little older, mm-hmm. that they don't have language around the dyslexia. And we start talking about, all of a sudden they realize, wait a second, so what I do here, it's also come from my dyslexia mind, or that's also dyslexia? And the answer is that you are through and through dyslexic. It doesn't show up just here or there. It's everything you do. The way you wake up, the way you dance, the way you eat, the way you relate to the world around you, that's also your dyslexia. So it's so empowering to have stories like these that allows the rest of our community to realize the wonderful experience that it is to be dyslexic.
It's interesting because you get people that come up to me and they say, you know, I'm a little bit dyslexic. Mm-hmm. And I go, oh, that's really interesting. It's a little bit dyslexic. Yeah, just a little bit. So mm-hmm. I said, so, okay, so we have a piano. Do you think Beethoven would be able to have, or Bach would have been able to have write his pieces if we take away, let's say, just the softest note? Let's just take it away because it's only a little note. It's only a little bit of a note on a piano. What do you think? So we'll take it away. Now we don't have Bach. And they go, but it belongs to the piano. I go, yeah. A little bit of dyslexia belongs to dyslexia. You are dyslexic.
Yeah. Somebody was telling me that they got over their dyslexia. I congratulated them. I said, how is it working out for you? Where are you not dyslexic anymore? But we are where we are. Everybody's in a different place. And some people have relationships and some people want to bring it out and talk about it. And some people are hiding their dyslexia. And that's what they're at, you know.
One person told me I could get rid of it by reflexology.
Yeah.
Wish him well with that one.
Yeah.
I said, but actually, I don't want to get rid of it. It's me. You'd be getting rid of me. And I don't mm-hmm. want that. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure a lot of our listeners, dyslexic or not, are wondering, how do you write? Describe your writing process to us.
Okay. So I love, thank you, Steve Jobs. Just let's go out there and say one huge, big, beautiful thank you. I never thought I could do this because of my dyslexia. So I used to write in children's exercise books, and my writing was like a five-year-old, and I'd write it about 100 times. And the first book, that's how I did. And then I bought a Barbie Lou seat. Do you remember those Apple Barbie Lou seat ones? They were brightly colored. I loved them. And you had a little handle. It just looked like Barbie World, really. And mine was blue. Ooh. And before that, someone had shown me a Microsoft, you know, and I thought, well, I can't use this. And I remember crying because it was all word-based. And I thought, this is so disappointing. And then this awful paperclip that jumped around all over the place. And I just thought, I can't do it. And then suddenly here was clean water. Here was someone who went, yeah, don't worry about it. I've got you. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I started, because I loved hearing the words go down. And I, you know, I can't touch type, but I really hit it like a hammer. And a friend came around and I said, it's just magical. You look at this. It's red, green, red, green, red, green, red, green. And she looked at me, she said, Sal, it's got to be a break. I went, no, look, red, green, red, green, red, green. She looked and she said, oh my God. I said, what? She said, the red is spelling, which it was nearly all red, and the green is grammar. I went, wow. But anyway, at least now it's not as bad as it was then. It was so bad. And then I had an editor who started to pull her hair out because she couldn't read anything unless it was spelt correctly. And a darling friend of mine called Meg Rosoff, who I love to pieces to creases, and she said, look, I've got a friend who works in film and she's a sort of continuity editor. She's a producer. She's looking for extra work. She maybe could look at this with you. And I think we should say the rest is history because we worked out the other day, we've been together now for 15 years, virtually working together. So what I do is I write and I then correct, I put it into 14 Arial and then I double space, and then I write again. And I maybe do about 7 copies on one chapter. I write again and again and again until I get what I call the beat of the thing. Mm. And then I send it to her. Sometimes it's more legible than others. And I am really bad at small words. So the os's, the to's, the it's, the was, the so's, all I see them, but they don't seem to be there. And then she reads it back to me. And I then hear it. And I go, no, 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 it should have gone da-da-da-da-da-da-bum. And then we get it back to going da-da-da-da-da-da-bum, just as I want it to do. Because to me, audio was so vitally important when I was growing up. All my books, I write to be read aloud. And if I don't hear the right beat in my words, then I've got to start again. Mm. And I think not enough writers, dyslexic or not dyslexic, don't listen to their words. And that is a tragedy. And you can really hear it when you listen to some audiobooks. You think, God, did this person never, ever listen to that? Mm. Did they really not listen? You know?
Do you know where you're going with the story from the beginning, or do you let it unfold?
I sort of, you know, like when you shoot an arrow in a wood, not that I've ever shot an arrow in a wood, but that's sort of a bite. I sort of feel if you sort of roughly got to know where you're heading with the arrow, you might not have hit the target. I always say when I set out on a book, I always say, it's not going to take very long, this one. Be very easy. And I always feel like one of those children who've got start right shoes and just walking up a hill and gets completely lost. And I'm still sort of wandering up the hill years later, still looking. No, I know who I'm writing for. I think that would be the thing to say, is I know when I'm writing for children and I know when I'm writing for adults.
Yeah, it's so fascinating to me. When we brand or design, I almost try not to know what it's going to be and really listen to the unspoken gestures and insights and habits and relationships and let it almost unfold and tell me, because I can kind of see when it's right, I know it fits that sort of space perfectly. It kind of holds all the needs of what we're doing and represents the understory of the efforts. It's a really interesting, it's hard to tell, but I jumping off what you're saying, I know who I'm designing for and what would make them move and feel in a way that's more than just trying to find the answer or the solution. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's called, I think it's empathy. I think what we're very good at, and you're very good at, is holding people who don't think they know what they want. You manage to see it in them and you pull it out and extract it. And that is a very dyslexic thing to do. I sort of, I always think, you know, we can sort of fly above a person and we can look around them while they're talking. We can sort of, we can almost put up their lives in our heads in a way. It's a gift. It is a real gift to be able to do it.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I really think that it is a dyslexic thing. I think that when we lean into it and we practice it, we get better at it. Like anything, we have a relationship with it, so we can be more sensitive to the range of, you know, the slightest of gesture that can tell the whole story. If we just be in it and not of it, which is a very dyslexic thing, you can kind of see it both what's happening, but also see it from the outside in at the same time. Yeah, I think it's a very dyslexic thing. A lot of dyslexic that we've talked to over the years can do that in different industries in different ways, you know, but there's a very common things there. And maybe part of it is that everything is negotiable. And because we're seeing through these letters, we can see through the person, through the conversation, through the details, and get all the senses kind of to work together.
I think it's because we're brave enough to be childish. I think because we've been so put down, a lot of us from education have suffered so quite traumatized with what happened at school, that we're not there with borders. We don't bring borders with us. We bring open fields and spaces for people to sort of say something. And that one thing we can latch onto and think, I've got you. I know what it is now. But I think a lot of people who think linear bring fields and borders and gates. And I don't think we do that. I think we are not necessarily great at that. I think we're very good at blue sky. We're very good at giving a lot of space to go rolling.
I want to go a little bit back to the beginning for a moment. Okay. How old were you when you were diagnosed with dyslexia?
I think I was 12, nearly 12.
And what was your childhood like before you were diagnosed?
Well, I have to put in here that it was fairly chaotic. My mother fell in love with another man and left us when I was 6. My brother was 2.5. And we were left with my father, who was not a very good dad. He was more interested in promoting his career. So it was a very worrying time. And my brother was very difficult. And we grew up in this very tight circle of lawyers in a place called Gray's Inn, which was part of the legal system in England. It was a very troublesome. I hated my childhood. I just honestly think I can put that down there and say I loathed it. And, you know, somebody said, you can come back again. The idea of having to be a child, just, I would say, no, pass me by. Thanks on that one. I've done it once. That was fine. I really don't wish to be a child again. No. I think that's what makes me a good children's writer, is that I absolutely have no love of being a child. And I understand that completely. And I think, you know, we glorify it too much. We think, oh, it's wonderful. It's not.
Yeah.
Bloody not.
When you write the children's book, do you write for your own inner child?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Yeah. That's beautiful.
I have this idea of myself when I started writing of a little girl in a glass dome reading a book. Mm-hmm. And as long as I write the books and keep passing her the little books in the glass, she stays quite calm. She's not going to break anything. But if that stopped, I think she's in trouble. Mm-hmm. For me, the way I've managed to navigate my world and stay sane is by my story. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just love story. I love playing with it. I love working it. And I think to really get good at what one's doing, it's like playing a violin. You've got to do it every day. You've got to fiddle with it, play with it, play with it, play with it.
So you were 12 when you were diagnosed with dyslexia. Yeah. What changed thereafter for you?
Not a lot, because I had to pretend I could master these words like boat, coat, moat, float, jote, because it was all on phonics, which never made any sense to me. And then I went to the school for maladjusted children. And it was so grim. It was so abusive. I mean, I think that did change me. I saw that I was loved. You know, my parents may be mad as hatters, but there was one day where I hadn't seen my parents for a long time and it was snowing. And we were in the middle of Suffolk in a sort of Tudor house. And all the kids were waiting, their little faces by the window, all looking out to see if any parent would come. And the teachers came up going, no, no one's coming. No one's coming. The snow means that no one will be here. And we were all being herded away from the window. And they were thinking, what the hell do they do with us? When I saw this mini coming down the road with my stepfather sort of glued to the wheel. And they'd driven all the way to come down to see me. And I remember looking at them and thinking, what, you know, that I was loved. Mm. I was a loved child and I love my stepfather very much, but when he took me, I said to him, you know, none of the children got picked up, and he went into a sweet shop and he bought all the sweets, and we bought everything virtually. We went home with sort of masses of things for the other kids, but it was a really tragic little place, really. Mm-hmm. Full of sort of, but in a way, I think for all its brutality, I think it showed me something. It gave me something. Mm-hmm. That gave me courage. I was determined that I was going to do something with my life. I was utterly determined. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I went to art school, and from being nothing, literally nothing, I just went like a champagne cork from a bottle.
Wow. What was that experience like?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, I tell you a very funny story, because this is quite funny. So I get into doing theatre design, right? I can't read the plays. Like, I've got a real problem here. There's nothing on audio. I can't read the plays. And we get a UNESCO play. I can never say his name, but, you know, it's very, very difficult. And all I can read is red telephone. So all I can read in the thing. Okay, all the words are just going, except for red telephone. So I make a white box, yeah, I put two doors because I think, hey, one needs to go out, one needs to come in, okay? And I make a little, I make a little table, and I sit on top of the table a red telephone, which I've spent ages making with a little dial, and I've done it. I sit on the table, and I know what I'm going to do. I've got it all in my thing. I'm going to say, I couldn't read the play. I'm severely dyslexic. I just couldn't read the play. I've got it all in me to say this, all right? So everyone's done these sets, and there's doors, and there's things, and there's masses of things. And the designer was a guy called Ralph Kultai, who was very sort of did glass boxes and all the rest of it. He was Polish. And he's not impressed by anything he's seen. And he gets to my set and he goes, what is this? And I go, and I'm just on my tip of my tongue to go. And he says, this is the work of a genius. This is the play. This is the play. This is the essence of the play. This is a telephone sitting as it. And I thought, oh, what do I do now?
I love that. Yeah, that just the fact that it kind of jumped at you and you had such a clear visions of it and the way it was interpreted was not at all what you thought. And all of a sudden, it just like changes everything, doesn't it? You loved being at school, going to university and going to the art school?
I loved it. I'm a visual thinker. So everything in my head, when I write my stories, it's visual. Everything is visual for me. And the thing about me is I could see the whole production, like you, when someone says to me, you know, I could see it all. And it was very frustrating that other people couldn't, and directors particularly couldn't see. They were very blind. And they'd go to me, and this is the thing. Oh, yeah, this is another funny story, but I can't really say the name of the director because he's quite well known. And anyway, it wouldn't be a very good thing to say. But I was doing my final with him and I was doing The Tempest, a play I absolutely loved. It's a difficult play to put on. And I was showing him all these books, I had masses of photograph books. I was showing him all the books. And I said, you know, of course it's like this, and then I'm going to do that. And I did it. And he said, I don't really see it. And I went, oh my God, you're blind. And he nearly hit me. And the thing was, for me, it was like the moment on the road to Damascus, as far as I was concerned. I've never been at all convinced of his conversion, but I was sure convinced of mine. I had thought all my life I was stupid because I couldn't understand why 2 and 2 make 4. I still don't understand it. But that everybody had a cinema in their head. I thought everybody did.
Yeah.
If I describe something to you, Gil, you could see it. You'd be able to walk around it with me. We wouldn't have to look at a book. You just know it. And it was just like, you can't see that.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary.
We talk a lot about in this podcast about our hyper abilities, you know, like what can we do? When did you realize that dyslexia was a positive rather than a negative for you?
That's a really good question. I think quite late. I think when I started writing, I think then I really began to see that all the years that I'd wondered about this tin can, I used to call it, that used to make a terrible noise as I went around a corner, I suddenly thought, oh no, you are actually a really quite interesting tin can. I had a love of language. I knew what I was looking for with words. And technology began to keep up with me. You know, in a way, I was born on the crest of a wave. And I, thank God, I could listen to audio. I could start, you know, word recognition had just begun to come in. It really was my time. And I was very lucky. I was really lucky. But I then began to see that this was a gift.
Yeah. What's the one skill, hands down, that is your hyper ability?
I think to play with story. I can turn a story on a sixpence. I can make it go one way, t'other way, around. I played with it so much in my life. I describe myself as, I love fairy story. So I describe myself as, I've sort of moved into the dark, dark wood and I built a house and I've never sort of left there. And I'm just constantly playing around with the stories in the dark, dark wood.
What do you do to dance with your dyslexia?
I talk aloud. I love telling myself my stories aloud. I think all writers are actors, really, quite sort of thwarted actors. But I don't feel I am because I know the rhythm. I'm waiting for the person to come. And sometimes they don't come, but other times they do. They just turn up and they say the most extraordinary things. I've said it before, but I often take them out, my characters out, have a meal with them And I sit them down and ask, you know, well, how do you think it's going so far? And I always think they're going to be really, you know, quite polite, you know, I don't think they're going to throw the book at me, but they have recently been throwing the book at me going, I wouldn't do that. That's not me. Yeah, I think it's the ability to, you know, even if it's a tin dim, let me put it a different way. When I did costume design, which I ended up doing for a long time, I used to ask one question, would you get out of bed and put on those shoes? Hmm. Right. And if I didn't think you would do, then the costume was a disaster. Mm-hmm. The same question is good for every writer. Would you get out of bed? Would you put on those shoes? Would you say those words? Mm-hmm. And if I don't think that's right, then I know I haven't got it. Mm. And I think I began to see that was a real gift, that I asked other people about shoes and they'd go, I don't know what you mean. I mean, well, you know, what shoes are they wearing? And I think that is, in a way, that is the gift. That is the gift. I haven't said it very well, but I know what I mean.
I totally follow you. Yeah, I know what you mean too. When do you get disoriented and how do you reorient?
Oh God, I get so disorientated. I get into such a panic about things. Oh man. I sort of have to take myself away out of a room really and sort of start again. Mm-hmm. I get myself into such a flap. I don't know if you do it, but sometimes I can't say words right the right way. I get the words round the wrong way as well. And then I really get this other Sally begins to haunt me. Well, Sarah, I think she's called, who just stands there going, yeah, yeah, look at you, stupid. You know, and that really aggravates the entirety of my situation when I get flustered. I think the problem for me and for what happened in my education has always been about having enough self-belief. Mm. I mean, I can sound bold as brass, but actually that is my biggest problem. That is the discombobulation for me, is self-belief. You know, why would you want to interview me for this? You know, why this? It is the lack of self-belief. You know, I do suffer from that. Mm. Imposter syndrome, I think I'd call it.
Last year, you and I did a project together, the Dyslexia Dictionary.
Yeah.
And you wrote this beautiful poem, Disobey Me, which I wish you were there to see it because we enlarged it. It was massive. I mean, it was massive on the wall.
Oh, I love it.
Maybe you've seen the photographs of some
The
standing, and they're literally standing, and it's exactly how I see words in dyslexia. They're standing inside of the poem. And the way you designed it and laid it out, which it was practically one on run-on sentence, you know, and we did it, you know, and it was a typewriter font, so it was very, you can feel the paper, you can feel the pressure of the letters hitting the paper. And so it really felt visceral more than graphically it was, you know. And one of the things that really stood out in the poem is like, I don't like the little world. They always disobey me, which I love. That makes me wonder, what is your favorite word?
Yes, I had quite a few that I loved. Discombobulate. Mm-hmm. Like that word. I think it was made up by Orson Welles. I don't think it existed before then. I like suddenly. Suddenly was made up by Shakespeare. And then it's like sticking plaster. You wonder what the world did without suddenly. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Then you think of all the words that, you know, Mr. Shakespeare went and made up. He made up like as well, which may be not so good, but he did.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing I love about writing is the challenge of not using like or as. Nothing is as something else. It can only be. And I love trying to get to what that is, to make it visceral, to make it you feel you're in it rather than it's like. I think in Maggot Moon, I say his heart was a boiled egg in a pan of water. I can't quite remember how I did it, but it was the image of the egg bouncing on the boiled thing. But it wasn't like it. His heart was an egg in a pan of boiling water. Mm. And I think the Irish have it a lot, that play of language, that ability to sort of say a panic of a man. He isn't like a panic, he is a panic. And I think that's one of my gifts, is finding things like that, that I love playing with words like that.
Mm-hmm. What question would you only ask a dyslexic?
Didn't they make it hell for us? Mm-hmm. And in a way, aren't we the richer? I have no idea what it's like not to be dyslexic, but I have no desire to live in their world. Mm-hmm. I have no desire to have a linear brain. No, I don't. I'm very pleased to have a linear brain help me, you know, make everything go. But I really want my mind. I like my mind. Mm-hmm. Crazy and mad and imaginative and inventive. Mm-hmm. I think half the reason people are so worried by us is we are explorers in the world of imagination. And we frighten people because we go and get off that train and we come back with all sorts of things that nobody should have been picking up. I think we are the people that go forward and think out of the box and find out where the next moment is.
Mm-hmm. What color is dyslexia to you?
Green. Green, it's always been, H has been green, and dyslexia always was green. Green bordering on that neon yellow. Mm. I think in a way, it's fertile. It's got possibilities in it. You know, there's a lot in green. It isn't just all blue and yellow.
I love green.
I love green. And I think it's, I did a book called The Double Shadow, and I use green in that a lot. To me, it is green, yeah.
Yeah.
I had not thought of it before, but it's definitely green.
Yeah. What is coming up next for you right now?
Well, I've got to finish this book that I'm struggling with that I have now on my, I think it's a fifth run through on this thing. And I'm going to get that done. And then I'm doing an opera. I'm doing a libretto for an opera, which I'm quite excited about. And then I've got a book that happened, well, 2 years ago. I went to a party just after lockdown. And I don't know about you, but I got really spooked by lockdown. And I hadn't seen people for a long time. And it was a HarperCollins party. And they seem to have got the Forrester Thane at the party. It was at the V&A, which is a Victoria and Albert Museum in London. And all these little waiters had trays with huge potted palms on it. So it literally looked as if the forest was moving. Mm. And I found it very discombobulating. And it was too many people. And I was thinking, I'm going to go. And we all had stickers. And I put my sticker upside down. And long and short of it was I stayed. I found some children's writers who were interesting to talk to. I wasn't so keen on the adult ones. And at the very end, I saw this guy who was the editor. And he said to me, "Have you got anything up your sleeve, Sally?" I said, "I have, actually. I've got a story about an umbrella." He went, "Yeah?" And the umbrella's called Panicketty Boo. And it's the most magical umbrella. It belonged to a sorcerer. And I told him the story. And he said, "I love it. I want this book." And that's coming out next year.
So exciting.
Yeah, I sold it in a party.
Amazing, amazing. So fun. You're always doing so many amazing things. You're so inspiring. I love, love always seeing you and talking with you and collaborating with you.
We're going to do something together, you and me.
You know, you've done the Dear Dyslexia postcard, another beautiful poem for that exhibition that we took all over the U.S. We took it to Congress this year, and
wow,
we've talked to schools, over 30 or 40 schools around the U.S. Thousands of students have participated, and adults and celebrities as yourself, and just really got the word out there that, you know, I find when you write a letter to yourself and then you put it in the mail and we get certified, it's almost, and then it arrives and you're sort of committing. You know, you're committing to yourself, yeah. You're promising to yourself, you know, so it's really an identity project that we've done together. And I'm always looking forward to working with you and playing with you and creating with you. So, but thank you so much for joining me today.
No, thank you for having me, Gil. It's lovely. As always, lovely to talk.
If you enjoyed our conversation today, be sure to subscribe to this series wherever you get your podcasts. Visit dyslexicdesignthinking.com to learn more about our latest initiatives, including Dear Dyslexia, the Postcard Project, or to book Gil to speak at your next event or conference. Stay connected on Instagram at dyslexicdesignthinking or drop us a line at dyslexia@gershoni.com to receive our monthly newsletter and learn about our upcoming programming. Dyslexic Design Thinking is produced by Gershoni Creative, a creative agency that builds brands. Learn more at gershoni.com. Until next time, be well.